On this week's 51%, you'll hear from recipients of a medal that exemplifies the ideals of Eleanor Roosevelt.
She is one of the great American heroes of all time. So to be spoken of in her honor and in her memory, nothing could mean more.
Plus, a Women in History profile. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Do not wait until some deed of greatness you may do. Do not wait to shed your light afar. To the many duties ever near you now be true. Brighten the corner where you are.
October 19th marked the 28th year of awarding the Eleanor Roosevelt Valkill Medal. The Valkill Medal Awards recognize and honor individuals who make a significant contribution to society in the arts, education, citizenship, philanthropy, community services, and other humanitarian concerns that reflect the former First Lady's ideals. The ceremony honors those who live their lives in the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt and serve as role models for the larger community, setting a standard for community values. This year's 6 medalists were honored during a ceremony at the Eleanor Roosevelt National Historic Site in Hyde Park, New York, the site of Valkill Cottage. I spoke with 4 of the 6 medal recipients, starting with 2011 Nobel Peace Laureate Lema Bowie, a Liberian peace activist, social worker, and women's rights advocate. She was named a Distinguished Fellow in Social Justice at Barnard College through the 2015 academic year. Bowie is founder and president of the Bowie Peace Foundation Africa and co-founder of Women, Peace, and Security Network Africa. I asked her what it meant to be awarded the medal.
In life, you find yourself in many places, and personally, people would think that I've gotten the Nobel Peace Prize, so what could this mean? But having a medal with Eleanor Roosevelt's name attached to my name is an awesome day, because she's someone you read about, especially for a girl like me coming from faraway Africa and being honored. I mean, just like being compared a tiny bit. I don't know how to describe it, honestly. And this is a really joyful day for me, because little did I know that my life would morph to a place where people in such a faraway place would recognize someone who comes from such humble background. So I'm humble, I'm honored, and I'm happy. I'm really, really happy and grateful to God.
As for what's next?
My life, the way I see myself is, as long as we still have to fight for women's rights, as long as human rights in many places is still an issue, as long as violence is still raging in parts of the world, as long as girls' education and women's reproductive health and rights and family planning is still a contentious conversation, my work is not done. There's still a lot more for me to do.
And I just wanted to, all those topics you just mentioned are an issue and contentious here in the United States. When you compare African countries to the United States in terms of progress, where do you see that?
Well, I think with the vast wealth and what they have in this country, you would assume that they would have been a long way ahead, but it's still shocking when you listen, and family planning is still a contentious issue in this country. Rape and abuse in many shapes and forms on school campuses is something that people don't want to talk about. So it's shocking, but again, I tell people the work that we do, we only find ourselves in different areas, but it cuts across borders. So no one can say we are at a better place than anyone, because humans, there are always complex issues when it comes to human beings. And I think what we need to do is just continue to work and not see it from region, but see it as people's problem. Yeah.
Next, I spoke with Geraldine Laybourne, a pioneer in creating innovative television programming for kids. She served as president of Disney ABC Cable Networks, vice chair at MTV Networks, and chair and CEO of Nickelodeon, which she transformed into the most widely watched children's channel in the nation. Laybourne is credited with breaking down doors in a profession initially closed to women. She co-founded with Oprah Winfrey Oxygen Media, a cable TV network for young women, which she sold to NBC Universal in 2007. Her recent work is with CanDo, a company she founded that aims to make technology more accessible to kids. Here's what the Valkill Medal means to her.
I grew up in a household where we worshipped Eleanor Roosevelt. My mother was one of those strong, confident women who believed in community service and the greater good and fixing problems in education and healthcare. And she grew up in rural North Dakota in a farm family and a very conservative, and Roosevelt was not popular. But she knew that Eleanor Roosevelt and Franklin Delano Roosevelt were awesome. So it actually caused her to break with the family in terms of politics. So it wasn't just a casual relationship. And I think for me, because so much of my career has been bringing on the next generation, it was this attitude that, you know what, women are great, we're different, we have different skills, we can solve problems in a more comprehensive, long-term, strategic way, and let's go to it. But there was no mistake in our family that you had to do good. My father was a businessman, and he kept adding, you must do well as well. But my mother's voice was much louder. And so I feel my sister was named after Eleanor Roosevelt, and Eleanor and her aunt. But my granddaughter was named after Eleanor and Eleanor Roosevelt. And so it's a very big deal for me. And Valkill is this kind of place that brought women together to support each other, nurture each other. And that's what I care about, you know, in all the business things I've done. I want to get women to the top of our companies, on our boards. We know that when women serve, they ask the most basic, fundamental, important questions, and they are not serving on boards to be part of a club. They're serving on boards to serve. And we know that we are not anywhere near where we need to be in terms of women in politics. We're only at 20%, some places 17%. We need to get to 30% in the next 5 years. And, you know, that's what I care about. So, you know, I don't really like getting awards very much, but this one I couldn't say no to.
Her granddaughter, who was named for Eleanor Roosevelt, Eleanor Padanovich, tells what she thinks of her name.
Well, I like it, and I feel like I'm my own person, and I can do a lot of things.
And she comments on her grandmother's Valkill Medal.
I think she deserves it, and I'm really proud of her.
Diana Nyad, in 2013, became the first person to swim from Cuba to Florida. She is an author, journalist, and motivational speaker. Her memoir is due out in 2015.
I have had a rocket ship of a year since the finish of the Cuba swim, Labor Day 2013. Been awarded, you know, by President Obama, been to the Cuban government and received the first American ever to have the Cuban Medal of Honor. But to be associated with Eleanor Roosevelt's ideals and her name, she is one of the great American heroes of all time. So to be spoken of in her honor and in her memory, nothing could mean more. What could mean more than a woman who was that bold and that brimming with integrity? So it means a great deal, believe me.
And I think it also speaks to not only your physical strength, for obvious reasons, for the swim, but the strength beyond physical.
Well, it does. I mean, you know, I think it was clear the way the world responded to that moment on the beach, that it wasn't about sports. It wasn't about, I'm going to speak about that today. It wasn't about an endurance record. All those things are quite undeniable and obvious. But for me, always, Cuba was living life large. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt, I don't have it right in front of me, but of the many quotes that she left us, one was something like, I don't want to be the person who just sits in front of the fire and lets life go by. I'm going to go out and seize it and live it as big as I can. And that's what Cuba was about. And when people saw it, they saw a person who said, I will never give up. I'll die trying to get across that thing. That's what they responded to. It wasn't the sports angle of it, you know?
I take it as, you know, you don't have to be a teenager or 20-something to really go for things and accomplish your goals.
Age is clearly a part of it. I was 64 when I did that swim, 65 now. So it does speak to, even I said on the beach when I finished, you know, you're never too old to chase your dreams. But the converse has been a message of it too. Countless children, thousands and thousands of children have emailed me and talked to me on Facebook about wanting to be chefs. One little boy wrote me and he said, I'm 11 and I want to have an Indian fusion restaurant. And why? Why do I have to wait until I finish college? I can do it right now. And, you know, he's right. You're never too young to chase your dreams either. So it's just really about, you know, we have a precious life, all of us. It's a one-way street. I don't care what your religious convictions are. We're not going to live this day ever again. And so that, I think that was the message, more than you can do it at any age. It was just do it and do it big, because you're never going to get it back.
Are you surprised by all the acclaim?
You know, maybe. In the beginning, when I came back to this in my 60s, I tell you the truth, the first thing I thought was, well, I had some notoriety in my 20s. I was the first woman to swim around Manhattan Island, and I set the world record swimming from the Bahamas to Florida, and I tried Cuba. It was always, you know, the big one, the swim of imagination and geography and, you know, of epic sort of proportions. But I thought when I came back this time, I thought the chances are pretty good no one in the world's going to care about this, because I was such a maverick back in my 20s. It was outrageous what I was doing back then. And I thought, today, you can just go to the local health club and get on a treadmill, and the woman next to you is about to climb Mount Everest, and the one on the other side is about to row across the Atlantic. I mean, people are doing phenomenal things on this planet. So I thought, who's going to care about this? But people did care, because it is. It's the Mount Everest of the oceans. And they maybe cared about it because of my ability to express myself about it and its epic nature. So now I'm not surprised, but I tell you, I'm privileged, because it's not about transient fame. Like, who cares if someone recognizes you in an airport? Honestly, if they're respectful and they say, wow, it meant so much to me and my family, what you did, we watched you, we cried, we believed that we can do what we want, that means something. But someone just to notice your face and get your autograph, that doesn't mean much to me. You know, tomorrow they won't be noticing me, so I better not think that's too important. Yeah.
What's next for you?
I am going to walk across America in the summer of 2016. My best friend from the swim, I have another best friend who's here with me today, but Bonnie, who is my head handler, we're going to walk, and we're going to try to get 1 million people to walk with us from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. And our statement is going to be, how did we, the United States of America, become this sedentary country where a third of us are now morbidly obese? A third. Children have diabetes. This is wrong. And it's because we don't move. You can't take the diet equation, you know, a part of the equation away. So fast food nation has to change and all that. But we could, the very least, start moving. And walking is the easiest, simplest, you know, challenge that anybody could have. And we are going to walk 25 miles a day for 4 months. And when we reach Washington, D.C., 1 million of us, we're going to say, now, America, let's get walking. These 1 million people are going to go home and start walking after dinner with our families, walking to work and having ergonomic backpacks and taking a shower at work and walking home. And 10 years, hopefully, after that walk, it will be the summer of 2016, we're going to see all those numbers, obesity and heart disease and diabetes, start to come down and down and down. So it's really a walk for social change. Get away from the screens. Kids especially, stop screen time and be out in nature, talk to each other, and walk. Get walking. Walk the walk.
Who can walk with you?
Anybody. It's going to be open to the wide world public. And, you know, people, of course, won't walk the whole way, most. They'll walk little sections of it, 25 miles one day. We probably will allow people to walk virtually. They can walk at home on treadmills, up and down steps at their work, and have our dedicated Fitbit that goes into our computer, and you'll be able to qualify for the walk. We're calling it the walk. So it's that simple.
Is there anything else you want to
say? I guess so, is that, you know, when you think of all the things Eleanor Roosevelt was and did, you know, the word humanitarian keeps coming up. She helped women. She helped the indigent, the poor. So when I think of, you know, why am I winning this award? You know, I'm not like the African woman, Lema, who's, you know, literally changing the lives of millions of African women. So I'm not out there truly dedicating myself, you know, to direct social change until we do the walk, but I accept it because I do think that it's important to dream. And when I finish that swim, which is, you know, another one of the great Eleanor Roosevelt's quote is, the future belongs to those who truly believe their beautiful dreams. So that's what makes people, that when you dream, it makes you become your best self. When you dream, you live life large, and you may not make it. If you've got a big dream and it's up in the stars, you may not make it there, but if you come even close, it's better than sitting around and letting it all go by. So I guess I never considered myself some grand humanitarian, but I think as a dreamer and someone who reaches for the stars, I would hope that if Eleanor Roosevelt were here today, she might applaud me and my team and Jerry and Lema and the other, you know, astounding people who are here today.
Another medal recipient was an organization, Aster Services for Children and Families, represented by CEO Dr. James McGurk. Aster Services is a community-based nonprofit organization that provides children's mental health services, child welfare services, and early childhood development programs. Aster serves children and families in New York State's Mid-Hudson Valley region and the Bronx. I wanted to ask you what it meant to be receiving the Val Kill Medal.
Well, I feel honored to be in such esteemed company. I mean, you know, with a Nobel Peace Prize winner, with Diana Nyad, and with people who have accomplished so much, I feel humbled. But I also realize I'm here accepting it on behalf of the 800 staff, the dozens of board members, you know, so it's not about me, it's about the work that we do, and I'm just very happy that it's getting recognized.
Where do you go from here? What do you aspire to from here?
Well, I think our philosophy has always been to do better, and to do better for the kids and the families. And I think when we see some of the challenges the award winners have faced and have overcome, it just helps me work harder on behalf of kids and families.
The two other medal recipients were editor and publisher of the magazine The Nation, Katrina VandenHeuvel, a frequent commentator on politics, and Ambassador William VandenHeuvel, founder and chair emeritus of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute and the Four Freedoms Park Conservancy. An international lawyer, he has served as deputy U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations and as U.S. ambassador to the European Office of the UN. Gilles Malkin closes our show with an edition of Women in History. This week, he profiles a revolutionary.
There was nothing really remarkable about young Sophie Scholl. She was an ordinary schoolgirl born in 1921 in southwestern Germany. She had five siblings, and her dad was mayor of the town. And she only lived until the age of 21. It was how she and a few of her friends stood unflinchingly against the Nazi regime and the atrocities they were committing, and more importantly, against the apathy and fear of her own people to oppose that machine, that set a new standard for courage in the history of the world. In 1942, Sophie joined her brother Hans at the University of Munich. He introduced her to his group of friends, notably Christoph Probst and Willy Graf. Their interests and discussions were about music, theology, art, and philosophy. They met to compare their views and share their questions with each other, as college students have always done, and inevitably the discussions of the group overflowed into political criticism. Sophie's boyfriend, Fritz Hartnagel, was a soldier, and he wrote her letters from the Russian front. She learned of mass summary executions, of the death camps, and of other horrors that, of course, were not reported in the media. But many people knew about them from similar letters their sons wrote them from the East. Hans and his friends were also sent into the conflict for a time where they gained personal knowledge of the facts. The students' primary focus became how one should react to tyranny and the oppression with which it stifles the populace. Their conclusions were simple, and they made no distinction between the idealism of their beliefs and their logical path of action. It was at this time that Sophie learned that her father had been convicted and imprisoned for having made a disparaging remark about Hitler, to the effect that if the war was not better run, the Russians would soon be occupying Berlin. Sophie was a Christian. She was raised Lutheran and believed fervently in the sanctity of every human soul and in common decency between all people. She was influenced in this direction by the anti-Nazi writing of the Roman Catholic Bishop of Munster, Clemens von Galen, who had been criticizing Hitler since 1934. She wrote to Fritz on the subject of the theology of conscience, as written about by the English Cardinal John Henry Newman. While the German people were backing the government simply because it was a time of war, Sophie's group countered that every citizen had a duty to oppose both. This idea would be the ethical and moral grounds for her defense when she was arrested. In 1942, as the group became aware of the extent of the military's barbarity, their call to action coalesced and they named themselves the White Rose. They began writing pamphlets to distribute at school, expounding upon the horrors which the military was perpetrating upon not only enemy soldiers, but upon millions of innocent people, and calling for resistance on the part of the Germans. This caused an immense stir at the university, and other students joined in the distribution process. As the group surreptitiously took up the use of graffiti, anti-Hitler slogans began appearing on buildings. The Gestapo was soon on the hunt for the source of dissent, but was stymied until a university handyman spotted Sophie and Hans moving a suitcase of leaflets and reported them to the authorities. They were arrested in February of 1943. They had only a mock trial, into which even their parents were refused entry. It took place 4 days after their arrests, and since they pleaded guilty, they were permitted no defense witnesses. The judge ranted at them and condemned them with overdramatic harangues. Sophie Scholl, nursing a broken leg from her interrogation, stared steadfastly at the judge and said, "Somebody, after all, had to make a start. What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They just don't dare to express themselves as we did." Completely undaunted, she told him, "You know the war is lost. Why don't you have the courage to face it?" Sophie, Hans, and Christoph Probst were convicted of treason and condemned to death. Willy Graf and other students were eventually similarly punished. Before Sophie's sentence was carried out, she said, "How can we expect righteousness to prevail when there's hardly anyone willing to give himself up individually to a righteous cause? Such a fine, sunny day. And I have to go, but what does my death matter if through us thousands of people are awakened and stirred to action?" The examples left by Sophie Scholl and her friends rank among the very foremost in courage across the genders. They're joined by many other unknown, unsung German men and women, about whose heroism and willing sacrifice we shall never learn. But knowing their words, we hear them call to us from their graves across the years, imploring us to keep vigilance over those who would buy and sell our souls under the guise of governance and send us and our sons and our daughters into murderous conflicts for their own interests. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Writer, composer, and actor Gilles Malkin is a resident of the Catskills region of New York. And that's our show for this week. We hope you join us for the next one. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1320.